So tonight is the fifth day of November, and we're learning the Torah portions that they never told us about, the book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy. Tonight we're getting to the sixth chapter of the book of Numbers. We're going to talk about the Nazir, the Nazirite, and I'll explain in a minute. And this week we're going to do it differently than the previous weeks. This week we're not going to focus on chronology, not on structure, and we're not even going to focus on exegesis, on understanding the verses. We're just going to use the verses basically as a jumping off point for a discussion of the question of, is it good to have a good time? Is it good to have a good time?
Yeah, it's good. I don't have to. I'm going home. I know the answer to that one.
You think you know the answer to that one? We'll see at least six different answers. A philosopher by the name of Mark Sokol divided the answers to that to six different categories, and he gave those six different answers very complicated names, as I have on the board. And it's really all based on a certain matter that comes up in chapter 6 of the book of Numbers. So here we go. Chapter 6 in the book of Numbers. I'm going to read from the beginning. I'm going to make some short explanations, but really, like I said, we're not going to concentrate on the verses and their specific meaning. We're going to use them in the same way that our ancient and medieval and modern philosophers use them as a jumping off point to prove what they want to prove about the pleasure principle, or is it a good thing to have a good time? Here we go. The Lord, let me just add that we mentioned in the first class that it's not clear at all why this matter of the Nazir, the Nazirite, is found here in the book of Numbers. How it fits into the chronology, to the subject, it appears not to fit in. And I'm not even going to deal with the question, why is it here? I don't have a good answer. And even if we had a good answer, it might not be that interesting or relevant. We're just going to take the parsha, take the matter on its own in a vacuum and see what it can teach us. Okay. The Lord spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the Israelites and say to them, if anyone, man or woman, explicitly utters a Nazirite's vow to set himself apart for the Lord. Now that word, Nazirite, in English comes from the Hebrew word nazir, which means a Nazirite, and the verb is lahazir, to separate. It means to separate, to exalt yourself, to separate yourself to God or for God. And the concept apparently is a concept that's known to the men and women there in the desert. The Torah is going to tell us the content of it and the value of it. But there is such a thing that people want to separate themselves from the world to serve God. That seems to be a concept that we're supposed to know about in general terms. So how do you do it if you want to do it? And by the way, it doesn't say how long you do it for, and it's an open question. You decide. The Talmud talks about 30 days or more. There were people who decided to be a Nazirite, as we'll see what it is, for 30 days or for 7 years. There's even such a thing as a Nazirite for life, which we're not going to talk about. Right in the Bible, there are two Nazirites for life, for 3 points. Who are they?
Samson,
okay. Another, the other one? This one, his mother's name was Hannah. Okay, you got 2 points twice. Right, so those are two Nazirites for life. We're not talking about that. Here, the Torah is talking about Nazirites for a certain time period, as long as they want to be. They decide from the beginning, they have to live up to what they vow.
And where does this Nazirite vow come from? I never heard of this before.
Where does it come from? Right here. But again, the concept that a person would want to take upon himself some regimen to come closer to God, that we can understand. But what exactly is that regimen? That's going to be right here. And is it a good thing or a bad thing? We'll talk about that for most of the class.
It's a voluntary.
Voluntary,
it's
totally
not, it's
voluntary.
Not a commandment anywhere. Okay. No.
The only commandment is just 1 second, is to do what you promise to do.
Once you commit.
Once you decide, and once you vow.
Okay.
Now, Samson, his mother was directed to make him, to have him be a Nazirite. And Hannah sort of voluntarily said, I'll give him to the Lord, my son to the Lord.
Yeah, and the Torah doesn't talk about such a concept that those two women apparently knew about a Nazirite for life. It doesn't talk about it at all. This is only a Nazirite for
What did they think? They were just going to, but they made that vow for the child.
For life, apparently. In the case of the mother of Samson, so the angel told her. In the case of Shmuel, Samuel, she seems to have understood there's such a possibility. But it's not related to what we're learning right now. It's related because it's the same word, same idea, but again, it's different.
So I know this is really off the subject, but is this where Catholicism got the...
It's very much related. I'm not a historian of Catholicism, but one would think, looking at it, yes, and the truth is that John the Baptist was Jewish, and he was a Nazir. He had taken a vow of being a Nazir.
And what are you supposed to abstain from?
Wait a second. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. Verse 3. He shall abstain from wine and any other intoxicant. He shall not drink vinegar of wine or of any other intoxicant. Neither shall he drink anything in which grapes have been steeped, nor eat fresh grapes or dried. Throughout his term as Nazirite, he may not eat anything that is obtained from the grapevine, even seeds or skin. So, any intoxicant besides wine, of course, refers to different types of beer and ale that they had, that they made from grains in those days. And wine, of course. And then there's looks like a fence around it. Not only wine, but even grape juice and even grapes, anything that could become is associated with, is similar to wine, has to stay away from. So why? Again, superficially, wine is one of the greatest pleasures of the ancient world. Right? They didn't have chocolate. They didn't have root beer soda. So what do they have except for wine?
So it's the sweet, it's the intoxication, it's the sugar component as well as the intoxicant. Because they didn't have chocolate, as you said.
Yeah. I think that all they had to drink was wine or beer or water.
Right. So they didn't have cookies and they didn't have necessarily cakes and all the good yummy stuff. So great.
Wine, yeah. Yeah.
But they could eat other fruit.
Get other fruit, right? They didn't have that many fruits, remember, in those days, right?
So, is this the only criteria?
There are two more, but this is the main one: staying away from wine, and it's a big thing, right? In our world, we think it's a little thing, but it means staying away from every type of drink that has any taste in it. In our terms, right? It was only drink they had that had taste in it. It was that or water. Water from the tap in Dallas, not so good. Verse 5, throughout the term of his vow as Nazirite, no razor shall touch his head. It shall remain, and the it is either his head or refers to the person, it shall remain consecrated until the completion of his term as Nazirite of the Lord, the hair of his head being left to grow untrimmed. So now what's that about? So some say that it's talking about a prohibition against personal grooming. Just like the wine thing represents staying away from pleasure, so the hair thing symbolizes staying away from personal grooming and like making yourself just a person not of this world. That's not part of society. That doesn't get the pleasure of normal looking good.
Because of the vanity?
It perhaps is a bulwark against vanity. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. I would think that there would be some component of cleanliness
and hygiene, because that's such a...
Because otherwise you get lice.
Well, it didn't say you couldn't wash the hair. No. You just couldn't shave it off.
No cutting.
Yeah.
Anointed.
Yeah. Yeah. There is another explanation of the hair thing, that it's not a prohibition against personal grooming and vanity, something else, which I'll mention in a minute after we read the third category. Throughout the term that he has set apart for the Lord, he shall not go in where there's a dead person. Even if his father or mother or his brother or sister shall die, he must not defile himself for them, since hair set apart for his God is upon his head. Throughout his term as Nazirite, he has consecrated the Lord. So that's the third thing. No wine, no cutting of the hair, and no contact with the dead. So what's no contact with the dead thing about? Not clear. I can think of two possibilities which are actually one and the opposite. No contact with the dead means perhaps a consecration of life. No contact with the dead, with things that had put an end to life, right? It's all about this world. But many commentators say the opposite. That no contact with the dead means no involvement in the social nature of funerals. And there were many more funerals in those days than today, right? It means even if your father, your mother, or your brother, your sister, your child dies, say you take a vow of Nazariteship for 7 years or 14 years, no contact with the dead, no mourning, no going to funerals, no going to a Shiva house. It's really staying away from a good deal of what social intercourse is about. So now, if we look at staying away from strong drink, the wine and the beer, and staying away from the dead, and I'll put the hair stuff on the back burner for a second, well, what might this remind of? What functionary in Jewish life also has to stay away from the dead?
The Kohen.
And the high priest, the same thing. He's not allowed to make himself impure for the dead, even for his father, mother, sister, brother. And also the Kohenim, the high priest and other priests, of course, are not allowed to drink strong drink when they go in to serve in the tabernacle. For the high priest, that's most of the time. So there are those who would say, and it seems to make sense, that taking a vow of Nazir is an effort to temporarily lift yourself up to the spiritual level of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And then what's the hair thing? The hair thing, perhaps, I'm giving you one take on it, is not a third element of things you have to stay away from. There's really only two, the dead and the wine. The hair is to create a crown on your head, like the plate on the forehead of the high priest that said, holy to God. It's a crown, it's a diadem. It's not something in and of itself essential. The essential parts are the no wine and the no contact with the dead. And it's to make yourself look different so everyone recognizes that you are a man of God or a woman of God. That's one way of looking at it.
This was not just men.
It says men or women. Okay. And we have, I didn't bring them for you, we have actually historical stories of women just as well as men that took upon themselves this matter of becoming a Nazir or a Nazira. Now, to go back to what you said earlier, Nazir is the Hebrew word for a monk, and Nazira is the Hebrew word for a nun.
So it's not like they wanted to have some form of a place for these people to then get together and have their own family.
Right, no, we don't have that. But again, they're not, these guys are not abstaining from procreation, right? Just wine and just contact with the dead.
They can have pleasure in other ways.
They can have whatever pleasures there are, yes. There's no, it was the Catholic Church, not just the Catholic Church, other religions that added the idea that the celibacy for the person of God.
And we have the two lifelong Nazirs, but otherwise, at the time that they, do they have certain?
Yeah, 30 days minimum, uh-huh. And we have records of people taking upon themselves for 7 years.
Wow.
I'll just add that until, might be till 30 years ago or 40 years ago, I don't remember, we had a living Nazir in Israel. The chief student of Rav Kook, right? Rav Kook passed away in 1930. His chief student was Rav David HaKohen, Rabbi David HaKohen, and he took upon himself to become a Nazir his whole life. He was a Nazir his whole life. He didn't drink wine, no grape juice, and he didn't cut his hair. And his son, the son of the Nazir, is still alive today. He's the chief rabbi of Haifa.
And he's a Nazir also.
No, he didn't say that.
Okay.
No. He's a very, very serious, he's actually very deeply involved in interfaith dialogue.
Oh. And what's the reason why people would choose to do this?
So what we have in the verses is an effort to set himself apart for the Lord. An effort to become more holy, to be more holy, to temporarily take yourself out of the world and devote yourself to God. That's what it looks like. And we'll talk about that later as we see all the different sources. I brought 12 sheets here of material. But they're half Hebrew. That's only 6, so don't worry. Let's go on with the verses. If a person dies suddenly near him, you know, it's in the middle of his period of nazirship, defiling his consecrated hair, the hair is the symbol of who he is, he shall shave his head on the day he becomes clean. Right? To become clean after contact with the dead is 7 days. You have to have sprinkled on you the water with the ashes from the red heifer the 3rd day and the 7th day, and then go to the mikvah on the 7th day. That's not related to Aziz, anyone in the time of the temple who became impure with the impurity of contact with the dead. So he goes through those 7 days. On the 8th day, he shall bring 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons to the priest. That's not what a normal person who becomes impure from the dead has to do. That's just for this guy, because this guy had his vow interrupted. He said he's going to be a Nazir for 30 days, and then the first day, or the 29th day, this happened. So he has to bring special sacrifice. On the 8th day, he shall bring 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting. That's the tabernacle. The priest shall offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering. We'll ask ourselves later, sin offering? Well, perhaps it's simple. The sin offering is because he made a vow and he didn't keep it. It was inadvertent. But the truth is all sin offerings are for inadvertent sin. For purposeful sin, there's no sacrifice in the temple. You just have to repent and hope for the best. It's only for inadvertent sin, for accidental sins, that there's ever sin offerings. So the priest shall offer one as a sin offering, as a burnt offering, and make expiation on his behalf for the guilt that he incurred through the corpse. That same day shall reconsecrate his head and dedicate to the Lord his term as Nazirite. And he shall bring a lamb in his 1st year as a penalty offering. The previous period shall be void, since his consecrated hair was defiled, and it begins again. And we have a story in the Talmud of a woman who vowed to be a Nazir for 7 years. In the 7th year, this happened. She had to do it again.
She had to start all over.
Right? So she ended up with 14 years. This is the ritual for the Nazirite. On the day that his term as Nazirite is completed, whatever you decided to begin with, might be 14 years, 7 years, 30 days, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. As his offering to the Lord, he shall present 1 male lamb in its 1st year without blemish for a burnt offering, 1 ewe lamb in its 1st year without blemish for a sin offering, why a sin offering? We'll have to ask that question a little bit later. He didn't do anything wrong. He's finished his vow as he was supposed to, but has to bring a sin offering. 1 ram without blemish for an offering of well-being, a basket of unleavened cakes of choice flour with oil mixed in, an unleavened wafer spread with oil, and the proper meal offerings and libations. The priest shall present them before the Lord and offer the sin offering and the burnt offering. He shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of well-being to the Lord, together with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer the meal offerings and libations. The Nazirite then shall shave his consecrated hair at the entrance of the tent of meeting and take the locks of his consecrated hair and put them on the fire. It's burnt. It's like an offering on the altar. That is under the sacrifice of well-being. The priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it's been boiled, 1 unleavened cake from the basket, 1 unleavened wafer, and place them in the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved his consecrated hair. The priest shall elevate them as the offering before the Lord, and this shall be a sacred donation for the priest in addition to the breast of the elevation offering, the thigh of the gift offering. After that, the Nazirite may drink wine. That's it. That's it. Now, what are we going to do with this? So, we're going to take note of the fact that these verses have served as inspiration for over 1,800 years of Jewish philosophers who dealt with the question, is it good to have a good time? Because ostensibly, if you just read the verses very, very, very superficially, they're saying to us that it seems to be not a good thing to have a good time, because if you want to come closer to God, then stay away from the pleasure of wine. So can we learn that from here? So I'm just going to, for 5 minutes, even less perhaps, just give a really brief introduction to this subject. So the question is enjoyment. Pleasure, whatever type it may be, physical, it's eating, drinking, sports, sexual intimacy, social discourse, whatever it might be, nice clothes, personal grooming, art. Is it a value in and of itself? to have that pleasure. Not as a means of something else, but really to say my goal in life, or one of my goals in life, is to have a good time. Would we define it as a pleasure? I'm sorry, as a value. Now, from a Jewish point of view, justice is a value. It's not a means, it's an end. Loving kindness, chesed, helping other people, is a value. Serving God is a value. But is pleasure a value? To have a good time for its own sake? That's the question. And if you say yes, then you have to ask, is pleasure the highest value, or is it one of our values? Now, the approach of hedonism means that the highest value, and for some hedonists the only value, is to have a good time, whatever it might mean. It doesn't mean that you're allowed to kill people or steal to have it. You don't have to be immoral to be a hedonist. It just means that you believe that the purpose of your life, the main, most important thing, is to enjoy yourself.
To be happy.
To be... that gets a little bit complicated.
Well, what did you say?
To be happy. You know, everyone says, I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. So I was going on.
Because being happy and getting pleasure are not necessarily the same thing. A hedonist would say that they are the same thing, probably. That the only way to really be happy is to enjoy myself. Other people might say no. That when I enjoy myself, I'm ultimately not happy. When I say enjoy myself, I mean pleasure in the physical sense. And I mean food, I mean drink, I mean sports, movies, entertainment, right? Art, perhaps.
Pleasurable diversions.
Except that a hedonist wouldn't call it diversion. He would call it the, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. It's not a diversion. It's the real thing. Work is a diversion. Right? I have no choice. I have to work to get money to be a hedonist. But, so that's one way of looking at it. Is pleasure a value in and of itself? And if it is, on what level? Hedonists say it's the highest or the only value, whereas you can take another approach, liberalism, which might say that pleasure is a value, but it's not the highest value. It's one value among many. Liberalism basically means laissez-faire, do your own thing, and since we like to have pleasure, therefore by definition for a liberalist, it's a value. Again, might not be the highest value. If it's the highest value, you go to hedonism. Now, on the other side of the spectrum, there's asceticism. Asceticism says that pleasure is bad. It's wrong. It is a contradiction to what it means to be a human being. And asceticism, if you go into it philosophically, is based on the concept of dualism. Dualism, that there are two elements to human beings, the animal, which is the physical, and the godly, the human, the real human, which is the spiritual intellectual. And someone who believes in asceticism would say that any indulgence in the physical is making yourself into an animal. The body is given to us as a repository, as a carrier of the soul, of the intellect, of the spirit. And it's not really who we are. It's just the bottle. Right? Don't get the bottle mixed up with the water. Right? There's no value in the bottle at all. It's just a shell. And anytime you indulge the body, you are basically bringing yourself down to the level of an animal. Make every effort to deny the body, to nullify the body. If something is pleasurable, and again we mean physically pleasurable, then by definition it's bad. And it's taking you off course.
Eating.
And therefore, eating should not be ruled by what's pleasurable to you. You should only eat to keep yourself alive so that your soul and your intellect can continue to do what it was meant to do. But to eat because it tastes good? That's what horses do. That's what pigs do. That's what dogs do. But human beings? Again, I'm not telling my own opinion. I'm just telling you what an ascetic would say.
And today I'm thinking the opposite. A horse eats to live. I don't think a horse.
That's a good point. But what we mean is that a horse eats. A horse doesn't think about why it's eating. It just eats because that's what it does. And to eat for its own sake. Mm-hmm. For the eating itself. Which means eating for the pleasure of it. And not eating for the right reason, which is to keep yourself alive. That type of eating, that we call it mindless eating, right, is horse-like. Is animal-like. Says the person who believes in asceticism. Now you can have extreme asceticism, right? In which we say that there's no value to the body at all, except that it's a carrier. And then we can come to, as we will later, more moderate types of asceticism that allow pleasure at certain points. But the extreme ascetic says no pleasure unless you have to, unless you have no way to stay alive without it. Well, you shouldn't sleep. That's, you shouldn't sleep for the pleasure of it. You should sleep the minimum in order to wake up and do what your soul was created to do. And here we come, indeed, to the idea of the ancient monks, the Christian monks, that would go out in a cave and try to elevate their souls beyond the body. Deny the body as much as possible. Fasting for days and days, no social intercourse, nothing but concentrating either on the spirit or on the intellect, on God or on...
Tibet monks also.
Say it again?
Tibet monks.
Tibet. Mm-hmm. Perhaps.
Or Tibetan.
Yeah, we have that, what I've heard in the radio and the newspaper of going so far beyond the body of lowering their pulse, so they're almost not connected, the soul's not connected to the body. Don't need the body. So
then how come physical intimacy is not part of this program? I mean,
good question, but the answer would be that it's pretty clear that Judaism is never, ever, 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 ever going to accept the extremes of 1 and 6. Extreme asceticism, you'll never find in Judaism. Here's one of the proofs. But the Torah is all about the body. The Torah does seem to give some credence to the body. There's a mitzvah of achalta v'savatu v'rakta, eat and be satisfied and to say a blessing after what you've eaten. But you're supposed to be satisfied. The Torah doesn't say it's bad to be satisfied. And the Torah is all about this world. Right? Christianity has a much easier time of bringing asceticism, even extreme asceticism, into its worldview. But Judaism, no extreme asceticism, just like there's no hedonism, saying that the only value is pleasure. No, there are many other values. Serving God, developing your mind, doing loving kindness, practicing justice, there's lots of other values that are at least as important, if not more important, than pleasure. So let's see. So I'm going to bring all these sources here. We'll just go through lots of different sources, and we'll see that all of the possibilities, except for the extremes, are really expressed, enunciated in different Jewish sources throughout the ages. And as we read the sources, I hope we'll be able to identify and understand the different positions and why one might take this position or that position. So here we go. Ready?
Where do you start?
I'm starting with page one. I'm not starting with page one. Page one was the chart.
Oh, okay.
Page two. I see the hole puncher destroyed part of the two. So this is from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Tani, the tractate that deals with fasting, and that's a good place to have a discussion of the Nazir. And we're going to read a passage that has two parts. We're going to read now the second part, where it says read now, and we'll read later the other part. So it says, Rabbi Eliezer says, in this discussion concerning the Nazir in the book of Numbers as we read, he is termed holy. As it is said, he shall be holy, he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. And that verse we saw, it's verse 5. The simple interpretation of the verse we saw is that the Nazir is holy. So it's a good thing. And then says the Talmud, if this man who denied himself wine only is termed holy, how much more so he who denies himself the enjoyment of ever so many things? Makes sense, right? So we can learn from here, says the Talmud, according to one opinion, that it's good to deny yourself pleasures. Now, how good it is, doesn't say. Does it mean like number one or number two or number three? It doesn't say. Now, number one, clearly it won't be. But number two or number three, how extreme is this position? It, again, doesn't say. It's taking the Nazir an example and saying we can even go further if we want to be holier, so we can deny ourselves even more things. Let's see another source I brought here on the same page. This is from Ethics of the Fathers, which is Pirkei Avot. And in the sixth chapter, in the brackets, you see, such is the way of life conducive to the study of the Torah. A morsel of bread with salt shall thou eat, and water by measure thou shalt drink, and upon the ground thou shalt sleep, and a life of privation thou shalt live. And in the Torah shalt thou labor. If thou dost thus, happy shalt thou be. And it shall be well with thee. Happy shalt thou be in this world, and it shall be well with thee in the world to come. That, by the way, is a statement that in Israel, every kid by the age of five knows by heart. In Hebrew, it sounds better than the English. And if you step back a second, which of course the kids don't do, but if you step back a second, look at it, wow, that's pretty harsh. That's pretty harsh. And it does seem to be in accord with the statement of Rabbi Eliezer that we read in the Talmud, that it's good to deny yourself. That's really the only way to reach the life of Torah. The only way to have the time and the wherewithal and the concentration to devote yourself to the spiritual, to the Torah, is to leave aside all those things that just get in the way. They're distractions. They're not of value at all. Now, you could say that this source in Ethics of the Fathers doesn't mean that you should do this as a way of life, but only temporarily to acquire Torah. Perhaps it just means for 2 years, for 5 years, for 7 years. But it's not clear. Perhaps it means forever. Because for the sages, the way of Torah was not just for graduate school, it's for your whole life, right? Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, the greatest mitzvah is learning Torah. You should do it your whole life. So it's not clear if
or
this...
In intervals in your life. I've never understood hedonism, because if it's all pleasure...
The pleasure is gone.
The pleasure isn't there. So maybe this would also... just as a contrast in your life, a day that, which
could be, it doesn't really say.
Way to look at it.
Well, and it says the way of Torah, it doesn't sound like a day. It doesn't sound like a day. I'd say at least 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. This is pretty extreme.
Yes, it's pretty extreme.
Judaism is not extreme, but that's pretty extreme. Just eat bread and water and lay on the floor and sleep.
That's where I think they meant like once a month.
No, it says, kach darkah shel Torah, such is the way of Torah. So it doesn't just mean every...
But you can do lifelong learning in your daily
life. So that's what you say.
Yeah.
But what does this say?
But does it say that? Just because you're going just by the phrase, such is the way...
That's what it seems to say, and that's the way the commentators take it.
So if this is true, I'm not saying that it's not true, but if this is something that as a person you can live by a morsel of bread and salt, and with just a measure of water, then how is it that the people during the Holocaust couldn't survive? That's basically what they got if they got.
So, I guess it's not meant to be taken literally in that sense, but it means the minimum of what you could survive on, right? And it's just going back to what Caroline said. still, even though this is a really harsh, radical source, we couldn't say that it's advocating a real extreme asceticism, because that would disallow so many of the pleasures that the Torah actually tells us to engage in. The Torah
it's
says...
It's not telling everybody to do this. There's no guidelines as to who is supposed to do this or when they're supposed to do it. You don't see hordes of people doing this. There's
you don't.
Isolated people
right.
that for whatever reason are choosing to do this.
Right.
So to me that's very confusing. If this... To your point, if it's true and it's what we're supposed to do, then why is it not more
prevalent,
widespread? Are people just choosing to ignore?
Again, we'll see lots of different opinions, and it certainly
okay.
isn't the mainstream opinion.
I was reading Rashi down mm-hmm. here. He says that doesn't mean that a wealthy person should reduce himself to a life of poverty, I guess that means. Yeah. But that even if a man be so poor as to be able to afford no more than bread and salt, study of law is nevertheless expected of him.
So I think that Rashi is trying to bring this into the mainstream.
Yeah.
But if we look at it on its own, it says what it says.
Yeah.
Right? But indeed, it could be that on its own terms, it doesn't mean everyone. It means those who are able to aspire for the highest levels. That's not for all of us. This is obviously not a mitzvah. It's not within the Torah, 613 commandments. The commandment in the Torah is the Nazir, which again is only voluntary for those who are looking for higher levels. The question is, if you're looking for a higher level of existence, is asceticism a way to achieve it? This source seems to say yes. Asceticism is a way to achieve a higher level of living, a deeper spirituality, a closer connection to God, and greater understanding of the Torah, according to this source, these two sources. Let's go further. The next page is page 3, and now we're in the Middle Ages. We're going from the Talmudic period, which is about the year, 200, 300 of the Common Era, and now we're going to the Ramban, Nachmanides, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, in the 13th century in Spain. This is 60 years after the death of the Rambam. This is the Ramban. And in his commentary on the Torah, on our verses in the book of Numbers, he says, it's the top of page 3, on the left-hand side of English, on the verse, and the priest shall prepare one for a sin offering. Remember, it says he's supposed to bring a sin offering when he gets to the end of his period that he vowed, and now he's going back to real life. Why a sin offering? The reason why a Nazirite must bring a sin offering when the days of his Nazirite-hood are fulfilled has not been explained. In accordance with the plain meaning of Scripture, it is because this man sins against his soul on the day of completion of his Nazirite-hood, for until now he was separate in sanctity and the service of God, and he should therefore have remained separated forever, continuing all his life consecrated and sanctified to his God. As it says, and it brings a verse from someplace else, from the book of Amos, where Scripture compares the Nazirite to a prophet, and has written all the days of his Nazirite, he is holy until the eternal. Thus, when he completes his Nazirite-hood and returns to his normal life, he requires atonement, since he goes back to being defiled by material desires of the world. And it does say in the Torah, in the verses we read, that when he finishes his period of Nazirite-hood, whether it's 30 days or 7 years or whatever, he brings a sacrifice, one of the sacrifices being a sin offering. What's the sin? So says the Ramban, the sin is that he didn't decide to stay in it forever. Now again, not everyone can become a Nazirite. It's voluntary. But once you do it, and you show you have the propensity and the ability to do it, so why not do it forever, says the Ramban? What's bugging you? What's urging you to go back to other pleasures? If you can do it for 5 years, you can do it for 50 years. So it's sinful, if you already got into it, to get yourself out of it. And of course, such an approach strengthens the hand of the two sources we saw already in the Talmud and Tractate Tanit and in Ethics of the Fathers, that there really is here an ideal to, as far as possible, to stay away from the pleasures of the world. They're certainly not values at all, and as much as you can do to stay away, the better.
Well, that's at least moderate asceticism, if not extreme asceticism.
Yeah, given that the Torah allows certain pleasures, we have to assume that no one is going to take a position, none of the Jewish is going to take a position that says you should always stay away from all pleasures by definition. But a moderate asceticism, we might have seen now in the Talmud and in the Ethics of the Fathers and in the Ramban. And now for the Rambam. This is going to be surprising to many of you. We're going to see tonight two Rambams, two different approaches in the Rambam. This one is the Guide of the Perplexed, which of course is the work that he wrote for those who are on the highest level, those who are searching really to reach the highest levels of spirituality, intellectuality, and holiness. And here he writes in the Guide to the Perplexed at the bottom of the page, by then, and he's talking about someone who's gone through a long period of spiritual training, by then he will have detached his thought from and abolished his desire for bestial things. I mean preference for the pleasures of eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, and in general of the sense of touch, things that are physical, that are corporal. With regard to which Aristotle gave a clear explanation in his Ethics, saying that this sense is a disgrace to us. It's disgraceful to be drawn after the corporal pleasures, because that's, again, animal-like. That's bestial. That simply takes you away from what it means to be a human being. And if you get involved in those things, you'll have no time and no desire and no room in your consciousness to search for and be involved in. That's what's really, really important in life, the spiritual and the intellectual, says Aristotle, and that's seconded by the Rambam. How fine is what he said, says the Rambam vis-a-vis Aristotle, and how true it is that it's a disgrace. For we have, insofar as we are animals like other beasts, and nothing that belongs to the notion of humanity pertains to it. The body is completely bestial. And that's a strong, strong statement, and that's really radical within Jewish thought. But it does fit with the other sources we've just seen. We're right up there with moderate asceticism getting pretty extreme. Right? Let's see another source. See, that was page 3. Now we go to page 4. And here's another source from the Guide to the Perplexed, the same Rambam. Consequently, one's recourse to these things, eating and drinking and copulation, should be reduced to the extent possible. One should do them in secret. Mm-hmm. Should feel sorrowful because one does them. Yeah. You shouldn't feel good about having to eat. It's a vice that I have no choice to stay alive. But it's not what's most important. Should feel sorrowful because one does them and not have them spoken of and discoursed about. No gathering should be held with a view to these things. Like going out to a restaurant together with friends and showing everyone that you're eating and that you enjoy it, that's disgusting, says the Rambam. That's like making yourself into a pig.
Okay, then help me with weddings, with bar mitzvahs, with everything that has...
I can't help you. You're right. The way we live our Judaism today is not what the Rambam's saying. No.
This Torah portion that talks about
hospitality.
Abraham inviting visitors and strangers into his tent to come and eat and be satisfied, and that's one of the greatest mitzvahs that you can do. That's totally contradictory to this.
It does seem that you're right.
And with creation itself, I mean, we see all these flowers of different colors. And we see all these different fruits and rainbows.
That's to tempt you.
Well, yeah, but I mean, why would God allow us to have all these beautiful things just for the light? I mean, a flower, it says, I mean, the flower comes in the morning and then dies in the evening.
Look, you guys are right.
I agree.
You guys are right. And the truth is that even though we find the Rambam saying it, we find Ethics of the Fathers saying it, we found Rabbi Eliezer in the Talmud saying it, the truth is, you can't really find any foundation of this in the whole Tanakh. You never find something in the Tanakh that says it's good not to eat and to stay away as much as possible from pleasures. This really doesn't seem to be what the Torah is talking about, except for the 20 verses of the Nazir. Right? There it did say, apparently, it looks like it said it's a good thing to stay away.
But it's for those who choose.
For those who choose it. Mm-hmm. But we should all aspire to choose it. We can't. Most of us, we're too weak. We're too animal-like. But if you really want to aspire to the higher levels, says the Rambam, then abstinence from just about everything you can. But you're right. It's not the way we live our life today. Not in Judaism and not in the modern world. Say it again.
Historically, that's not how Jews...
The majority, you're right. But we certainly did have groups of... individuals.
Who practiced.
Who did their best to stay away. Let me remind everyone, anyone who was here when we had our class about Sukkot a month and a half ago, was anyone here? Okay, not too many people. But I mentioned that there was one commentator, the Rav Yitzhak Arama, in the end of the 14th century in Spain, who wrote that the idea of the sukkah is to leave behind your house and your car and your swimming pool. He didn't say that, right? And go into the sukkah with a little bed and a chair and a table. And he said it's to make you realize that you don't need anything else. That you should never want to go back to your house. That's what he said. Now that's not what other commentators said, that's what he said. And that fits in with this same approach of either modern asceticism or ascetic neutralism, but it's telling you what Rav Yitzhak Arama said, the true possessions in life are not physical. The true possessions are what you have in your heart and in your mind. And the possessions... He was talking more about physical possessions than about pleasure, but they're really the same thing. They only get in the way. Too many possessions get in the way of real spirituality, just like we're saying here, that too much enjoyment, or any enjoyment at all, any pleasure at all, gets in the way of what's really central and really cardinal in life.
Well, I mean, I certainly know people that have an awful lot of things, stuff, whatever, and they're not happy. So that's a given. You can be unhappy. But it does seem like this beautiful world that we have, that we were put on this earth to enjoy all these things.
Pleasure of others.
The colors. Mm-hmm. So it's not like black and white. We have seven different colors.
In the early parts of the beginning of the Torah where, you know, God creates woman to be with man because man is not supposed to be alone. The whole thing of humans goes against that. I mean, they're really saying that you should isolate yourself.
If you tell me this is just for the Nazirite or for the Nazir, and you know this is not something that all of us should aspire to, I could understand that.
He's saying all of us should aspire. Most of us are animals. We'll never get to that level, right? But we should aspire. But look, you guys are all right. And the truth is, what Carol Ann just said and what Kayla just said, we're going to see another half an hour in a passage from the Talmud of the Land of Israel that says that it's actually sinful to deny yourself from the pleasures of the world. Different approach. There's lots of different approaches here. But they all find their place under the big tent of Judaism. Now, of course, the things that the Rambam said here that you guys are objecting to, well, you guys are not the only people that objected. We'll see in another few minutes that a certain writer came out very strong against the Rambam and said, that's ridiculous. That's terrible. How can you say that? But just give me one more shot at it. But I do want us to try to understand where it's coming from. Try to understand the deep sense of liberation and of uplift that one can have when you go beyond physicality. There is such a thing. There really is such a thing.
And that's part of the reason why we fast on Yom Kippur, right?
Yeah. So Yom Kippur, 365 days a year. If it's good one day, then why not? Well, I'm serious. I'm not completely serious. I'm 99% serious, right? Because I understand that at the end, we're going to reject this. Because we're modern people. We can't identify this completely. But it is important to try and understand where it's coming from. Try and understand where it's coming from.
Well, you do see, when you read or see films on the Tibetan monks, there is a peace and serenity that is absolutely palpable on their faces is those individuals want to go to that level. But I guess the problem I'm having, the majority who don't, are animals. That's the hard part. I don't find a problem with the Nazirs or the Tibetan monks or the Christian monks. That's what they've chosen. And there's a certain person...
Rambam would
say that he was such an elitist.
But where was he in this? Was he in Nazareth?
The Rambam indeed made great efforts to live by what he preached.
So he was considered a
Nazir? No, not a Nazir in any type of halachic sense, but he devoted his whole life to study and to teaching.
So does it say basically that God will provide?
It's related to that, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all. You can work 4 hours a day, make enough to eat the little bit that you have to eat, and then spend your time in spiritual, intellectual pursuits. This is not necessarily related to what you're saying, but it's a certain connection, I think.
Well, some of those monks just go around each day and beg for their...
Yeah, but others, they have farms and they have ways of sustaining themselves.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse that talks about, you know, the Buddhist, I don't know what it's called a monk, just have nothing. They own nothing but their one piece of clothing and their begging cup, and that's all. And as strange as it sounds, there really is a certain deep sense of liberation from the pettiness of this world. Okay, then forget about the begging part of it. So work an hour a day. But it's liberation from the body, liberation from the shackles of the physical, of the animal-like, of the corporal, and just concentration on God, who is all spiritual and all intellectual.
That's why I think God needs to provide.
It is liberating. I can see that it would be liberating.
You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Have a little bread and water.
There's so much more time. There's so much. Your vistas open up to see so many more things when you're not concerned so much with the narrowness of the physical. Okay, now, here's an interesting historical point. For six generations, the Rambam's descendants were the leaders of the Jewish community of Egypt. For six generations. Son, 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 son. And now we're reading from the Rambam's grandson, the third generation, Rav David Maimuni, who wrote a book called Guide for Abstinence. And I just took here two little paragraphs of it. Abstinence is necessary in order to establish spirituality and erase the physical. This is because establishing physical forms and that which accompanies them in the soul causes the erasure of the lights from the soul. It's one or the other. Body or soul, you can't have both. They're in conflict. An abstainer is one who takes a Nazirite's vow from the pleasant things of the world and its enjoyments and distances himself entirely and turns from everything that is not God. Abstinence is seclusion and separating oneself. That's kind of new here. You guys mentioned it, but the sources didn't. So he's going quite far. And indeed, the Rambam's children, his son, his grandson, his great-grandson, they became very close to the Islamic Sufis, the Islamic mystics / sometimes hermits. So, let's go on to page 5. Since till now, at least in the Rambam, and in the Rambam's grandson, we've seen a position that's probably moderately ascetic. Again, extreme asceticism, no, but moderate asceticism. Now we're going to go to the Ra'avad, who was a younger contemporary of the Rambam. The Rambam, remember, died in 1204 of the Common Era. The Ra'avad was in his 30s when the Rambam died. His name is Rav Avram ben David. Ra'avad is an acronym. He wrote a book called Gates of Holiness. And the position he's going to take, we're going to call ascetic neutralism. And I have a beautiful metaphor for it. Or those who take the position of ascetic neutralism, physicality is not bad in and of itself. For the Rambam, was bad in and of itself. But for these guys, no, it's not bad in and of itself. It's neutral, but it's really dangerous. Example being that pleasure is just like crossing the street. There's nothing wrong with it. But for the ascetic neutralists, the street is 635, and you're on foot. It's really, in and of itself, not bad, but it's really dangerous. So as much as possible, stay away. So here's Balei HaNefesh, and I have to tell you a story that I'm not even sure how I relate to this story. When I was 25, in about 1983, when I got engaged to get married, I asked my teacher, the Rosh Kollel, the head of the group of guys learning for ordination, I asked him, so what can you advise me? I've got to get married in 3-4 months. What book should I read? And this is the book he gave me to read, this particular chapter. And the reason I don't know how to relate to this is because it's just not fitting to the 20th century. And I felt that a little bit when I was reading it, but I couldn't really enunciate it. But looking back on it, it's not the right thing to read for a young man in the 20th century getting married. So here we go.
Wait to see what he said.
Now you should understand and know that man cannot achieve this quality of sanctity of the heart unless he abstains from a portion of that which is permissible to him, and fences himself with the fence of abstinence, and abstains from things which are permissible to him because they are a path to habitual sin. All this sexual abstinence serves as a fence against sin, so that the desire for illicit sex does not gain strength. Because if, after satisfying his desire with that which is permissible, he can no longer find permissible things, his desire will seek the forbidden. And now we must know and discern that the right intention is for engaging in this action of sexual activity, and what kind of intention corrupts it, and causes the person to lose his reward for filling a mitzvah, and brings upon him evil instead of good. I have inquired into it and analyzed this issue with my limited intellect, and have found that the action can only have 4 justifiable intentions. In other words, there's nothing wrong with crossing the street, but you only do it if you have to get to the other side. In and of itself, this is valueless. Pleasure is valueless. It's not bad, it's not good. But you only do it if you want to accomplish something else. It's not a value in and of itself. There's no reason to pursue pleasure. It's like someone who just walks back and forth across the street from side to side. There's no point in it. If you want to get to the other side, then it's good. But if it's 635, you really should be careful, extremely careful, and not do it too often, even if you have good reason to do it. So he's saying, so now the third paragraph here is a summary of many paragraphs. This is not the original language we're reading out. This is just from an article that summarizes. So he says, these intentions, the ravats, are there are 4 acceptable purposes for sexuality. Propagation, satisfying a spouse's sexual needs, but not your own. Improving the health of the fetus. They believe in those days that sex helps, if a woman is pregnant, it helps the fetus to develop. And preventing oneself from sinning. In other words, that one should have sex if he's afraid, for a man, that he'd go out to a prostitute if he doesn't do it permittedly. So if he doesn't do it in a permitted fashion, he might end up doing it in a illicit fashion, so do it in a permitted fashion. But it's for the purpose of something. It's not for itself. It's for your spouse. It's for the fetus. It's for not sinning. It's for propagation. But it's not for itself. It has no value for itself. Where these 4 legitimate motives are absent, the Ravad concludes, and the intention of the one who engages in sexual activity is solely for the purpose of personal pleasure, then he comes perilously close to sustaining moral and religious loss.
So, I think that's just ridiculous.
I understand.
Your rabbi felt agreed with that and doesn't believe in marriage as we think of it today. And he's saying, you do it. That's your thing. And you only do what you have to when you have to.
But don't enjoy it.
He doesn't say don't enjoy it. He said don't do it for the purpose of enjoyment.
By the way, you have a good time, then it's okay.
Well, I don't know about that. I would think it's more a matter of, but if your wife wants something, you need to please her.
Right.
But it's not for you.
Right.
Oh.
Right.
So if it's kids, if it's enjoying your food, you're enjoying it because she wants you to enjoy it, not because you want to enjoy it.
Well, if we're talking about sex. If you talk about food,
okay, food, sex,
you eat because you have to fill your body so that you can serve God. You have sex so that you can accomplish the mitzvah of procreation, but not for its own sake. If there's pleasure in it, okay. But of course, the pleasure is dangerous because you might want to do it again when you don't have a true goal, a good goal. So this is really about crossing 635 only when you really have a good reason for it.
It's a slippery slope that once you start down.
Yeah, all this physical stuff is a slippery slope.
If that's the case, then why wouldn't sex be prohibited except for the times when a woman is fertile and you?
That's a good question. That's a good question, I think.
A child.
And the truth is, that is absolutely one of the points that is brought against this approach within the internal Jewish dialogue of which is the true, quote unquote, the true Jewish approach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that point is absolutely made. Yeah. But on the other hand, the Ravad has been read and accepted and venerated for generations. Not as the only approach, but as a very, very legitimate Jewish approach. And
this
here we have...
This last paragraph, it sounds like, I think it's talking about masturbation.
Right, yeah. The last sentence, you mean?
Yeah.
So again, that we're going to call ascetic neutralism. That physicality and pleasure is not bad in and of itself, but it's neutral and it's not a value. It's only to be done for a different, better, higher goal, and it's also dangerous. So now it's getting interesting, right?
No, it's been interesting.
It's been very.
So now, at the top of the next page, I wrote to go back to page 2. Right. So you're going to go back to page 2.
No, I thought we were going forward.
I'll just go to page 2.
Because remember, back on page 2, we're on the left-hand side at the top, or the middle, where it says for page 9. Remember, we've read a little bit of the passage, now we're reading the beginning of that passage. So it says there, Samuel said, this is one of the rabbis of the beginning of the Talmudic period in Babylon in the year 220 approximately. Whoever fasts for the sake of self-affliction is termed a sinner. He is of the same opinion, Samuel is, as the following Tana, the following rabbi. For it has been taught, Elazar HaKapar Berebi says, what is Scripture referring to when it says of the Nazarite and make atonement for him for that he sinned by reason of the soul? Against which soul did he sin? It must refer to the fact that he denied himself wine. We can now make this inference from minor to major. All the more so argument, if this man, Nazarite, who denied himself wine only is termed a sinner, how much more so he who denies himself the enjoyment of ever so many things? Until now, we notice that it says the Nazarite is holy. Mm-hmm. And that was the second opinion here that we read half an hour ago. Rabbi Lazar, he's holy, so the more you abstain, the holier you are. But now Shmuel and Rabbi Lazar, HaKapara, they point out that it says the Nazarite has to bring a sin offering. Now the Ramban said the sin offering is for him stopping being a Nazir. But this opinion says, no, the sin offering is because he was a Nazir to begin with. He has to have atonement for becoming a Nazir. To be a Nazir is a sinner. We'd have to say the Torah gave it as an option as a concession to human weakness. Some people, they think they want to approach God by abstinence, so we'll give them the framework. But it really is something you shouldn't do, according to this. And if the Nazir is a sinner, and all he did is abstain from wine, then all the more so are people who abstain from other things, sinners, and even greater sinners. So now we've moved from asceticism, whether it's extreme moderate or ascetic neutralism, we're moving to 4, 5, and 6, that it's wrong to abstain, meaning there's some type of value in pleasure. We'll see liberal neutralism or liberalism or hedonism. Again, hedonism, we won't ever go that far, because if we did, we wouldn't be in this room. But we'll see two different types of either liberal neutralism or liberalism, which means that in some sense, on some level, there could be a value, or at least there's no sin. Let's not say it's a value, that's going far, but there's no sin in pleasure. It's not bad. And the prime expositor of this approach is none other than the Rambam. But not in the Guide to the Perplexed, but in a different book. In the Guide to the Perplexed, he's in favor of asceticism. But here, on page 5, is it, or 6? No, 6. On page 6, the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, which is his magnum opus of halakha, here he's in favor of a position of liberal neutralism, which means that there's nothing wrong with pleasure and there's nothing right about pleasure. It's totally totally neutral. It's like crossing the road, but not 635. It's just like crossing a country road. But you know what? You don't cross a country road unless you want to get to the other side. It's not dangerous, but it's a waste of time unless you want to get to the player. Where? So in other words, there has to be a value, a goal, an end, and for that end, if it involves pleasure, then fine. Nothing wrong with it. And it's not dangerous. It's just a waste of time unless it has a higher purpose. So says the Rambam, a person might say, since envy, desire, the pursuit of honor, and the like are a wrong path and drive a person from the world, I shall separate from them to a very great degree and move away from them to the opposite extreme. Right? Envy is bad. Someone has 3 cars and you want them. Desire, that's bad. You have to stay away from it. So if it's bad, then perhaps I should stay away from all those things that arouse envy and desire completely. For example, don't eat meat, nor wine, don't live in a pleasant home, nor wear fine clothing, but rather wear sackcloth and coarse wool and the like, just as the Gentile priests do. That's what you mentioned an hour ago. It's probably referring to the Christian monks. So if you think that's the right path, he says, think again. This too is a bad path, and it's forbidden to follow it. To abstain for the sake of abstinence is a bad path. Even though in the Guide to Perplexed, that's exactly what he said to do, but he was saying something different, and I have no explanation why he has 2 different...
Well, the Guide to the Perplexed was for the very elite.
Perhaps, right?
This
perhaps
is for our everyday people here. He knows the rest of us aren't going to get up there. So.
Yeah, that's a possible answer. Absolutely. This, too, is a bad path, and it's forbidden to follow it. Whoever follows this path is called a sinner. As implied by Numbers 6, statement concerning a Nazirite, and he, the priest, shall make atonement for him for his having sinned regarding his soul. Our sages declared, if the Nazirite who abstained only from wine requires atonement, how much more so does one who abstains from everything? We saw that 5 minutes ago. Therefore, sages directed man to abstain only from those things which Torah denies him, and not to forbid himself permitted things by vows and oaths of abstention. Thus, a sage stated, are not those things which the Torah has prohibited sufficient for you that you forbid additional things to yourself? Okay, let's go on to the next page. Time is really late. So you know what? Let's not read the whole next page because time is late. The Rambam's approach in general to ethics is instrumental. In other words, there's means and there's an end. The end is serving God. And everything you do, he said, should be an instrument, a means, a vehicle towards serving God. it's okay to sleep, it's okay to eat, it's okay to go to a basketball game, it's okay to put on nice clothes. It's all okay if the purpose that you're doing it is to serve God. And then he gives examples. You should learn Torah 12 hours a day. But if you get tired and your mind wanders and you feel you have to go to a basketball game for the purpose of having greater focus tomorrow, then that's great. He talks about going to museums to clear your mind. That's fine. Not as a goal, but as a means. And if that means involves pleasure, that's fine. But it's just like crossing the road. And you only do it to get to the other side. It's a means and not an end. If you make it to an end, then it's wrong.
So it's never a value.
It's not a value. But it's also not bad. It's not good, it's not bad. That's the whole approach of the Rambam here. And everything you do, you should think why you're doing it and do it only if it brings you closer to the end result, to the goal of serving God. And that again is what we're going to call liberal neutralism. Page 8. Page 8. Okay. So page 8, I'll just tell you very briefly, this is called the Holy Letter. It was written in the 13th century in Spain. It used to be attributed to Nachmanides, the Ramban, but today we know it wasn't written by him. And what it is an attack on what we saw in the Guide to the Perplexed. And it basically says, you can't say that physicality and sexuality is wrong. Because it's not. It's simply a means which could be very holy. And it's a Kabbalistic work that talks about the holiness of union between men and women. Not for enjoyment, but because it's a symbol of the union between the Shekhinah and the Jewish people. And it's not bad sexuality, but it's also not good. It's a means, just like we saw in the Rambam. Again, this is the liberal neutralism. It's a means. And it's a means that there's nothing wrong with it. And since time is short, we're going to skip page 9. We're going to skip page 10, and I'll just tell you what they say. There's a few commentators on page 9 and 10 that say we've missed the boat until now. That in looking at the Nazir, the material about the Nazir in the book of Numbers, and trying to ask ourselves, is it good to be a Nazir because it says it's holy? Or is it bad to be Nazir because it says he has to bring a sacrifice of atonement? That's the wrong question. It's not good or bad. Rather, it's a corrective measure, temporarily. In other words, the position that we're skipping says that there's nothing wrong with pleasure and enjoyment and physicality. Certainly, we're not going to asceticism or neutralism. We're going to take a position of neutralism or even liberalism, that there's nothing wrong with pleasure at all. It's just a means, or perhaps there's even something a little bit right with it, like liberalism. And how should we understand the Nazir, where it says that it's holy? Because that's for people who need it as a temporary corrective. Someone who's gotten too much involved in the physical world. You should be involved. You get too involved. It's like a diet. It's not a value to take in only 1,500 calories a day. It's not an absolute value. It's a value for someone who has to lose weight.
It's almost like talking about curing addiction.
Exactly.
Somebody who becomes so obsessed with alcohol has to go completely
cold. Yeah, exactly.
To get past it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why the Torah said two things that seem to be contradictory. That the Nazir is holy and the Nazir is a sinner. They're both true. He's a sinner in that he shouldn't have gotten to himself into the position in which he has to go on a diet. So he's a sinner. But that he went on a diet, that made him holy. They're both true. So you can't learn from the Nazir, even though it says that he's holy, that it's holy in general to abstain. When is it holy to abstain? When you need to. A number of commentators point that out. And that makes a lot of sense. Then in general, perhaps, you shouldn't be a Nazir unless you need to be a Nazir. You have to be aware of who you are and where you're going, what's happening, and you have to know when there's a need to be a Nazir, you have to be a Nazir. It's nothing to be proud of, it's not a value to abstain, but it's a value in a certain context. Pretty simple. And the last two sources I want to see are those that go in this last direction of liberalism, that there is a real independent value of some sort in the pleasures of this world. And many of you, you've been waiting with bated breath to see the source, right? Carol Ann basically paraphrased it a few minutes ago, and it's on page 11 at the bottom. Page 11 at the bottom. From the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud of the land of Israel. Rabbi Chezkiah, the son of Rabbi Kohen, by the way, it's rare to see the word Kohen as a person's name in the Talmud, only place I'm familiar with, said in the name of Rav, in the future, man will be taken to account for all that his eyes saw and did not eat. Rabbi Laza was concerned about this teaching. He took it seriously and wanted to live by it. And so he saved his pennies to buy each new food as it grew during the year. And that's what Kayla said also, that there are good things in this world. And we should understand that they were created for us to enjoy. There's nothing wrong with enjoying them. And actually, you'll be taken to task by God, it says, if you abstain and don't enjoy. That God gave you all these things and you don't accept them. You throw his gifts back in his face. Mm-hmm. Not nice. That doesn't mean that enjoyment is the only value or the highest value. It doesn't mean it trumps other values of justice and goodness and righteousness and ethics. No, but it is, among other things, among many other values, it's also important. And at the end, we'll just read from Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, who wrote about this a little bit in the last page. And this is in the 20th century. We're going to read at the bottom of page 12 and then at the top. So in Rabbi Soloveitchik's work, Halachic Man, he wrote the following. And this will just be an introduction to what we have at the top of page 12. The aspiration to achieve a state of ascetic transcendentalism, the negation of life and this mortal world, the annihilation of existence and reality, the reaching out of the religious personality to the ethereal world that stretches beyond the confines of tangible existence, is embodied in many of the systems of conduct involving asceticism, vows of abstinence, withdrawal from society. The religious personality sometimes imagines that afflictions, suffering, fasts, and solitude constitute the media bringing a mortal happiness to man. According to this outlook, the man who withdraws from the world and forgoes earthly and ephemeral pleasures is rewarded with eternal life and a sublime spiritual existence. But he says that that's what some people imagine. His position is different. His position is at the top of the page in a different work that he wrote that's called And You Shall Search. Halakha requires man to enjoy the beautiful and lustrous creation no less than the man of pleasure. I have to explain, he writes many of his works in a form of topology. That is, he divides human beings into different types. And there's a man of pleasure, there's a man of halakha, there's a man of the spirit. So he says that the halakha, Judaism, requires us to enjoy the beautiful no less than the man of pleasure, the hedonist, requires himself to enjoy pleasure. But there's a difference. However, halachic man's pleasure is improved and refined. The pleasure of the person who has descended into the very heart of pleasure and has understood its essential nature. It has in it something of the aesthetic attraction to pleasure felt by the satiated man, who has tasted fully of the world and not found complete solace. You know the feeling of everyone, imagine your favorite food. And I'm just going to think of Chinese food or root beer soda. It's one thing to have your favorite food when you're really hungry. It's another thing to have it when you're almost full. And Rav Soloveitchik is saying, that to search for pleasure with that mindset of the hungry person, no, there's a little bit of the animal-like in that. The pleasure that's at the highest level is the pleasure you get when you're almost satiated. Because then it's more refined. Then it's more slowly, you savor every bite, and you're able to really to think about the nature of delicious food instead of just gobbling it up because you're so hungry. That's what he means when he says that the pleasure that we want to focus on, that's a value for us, is similar to the pleasure of someone who's already satiated, who has tasted fully of the world and not found complete solace. It also has in it something of the moral dimension of commanded man who is afflicted by his drive for pleasure and who controls it. What the Torah hates is the emptiness in pleasure when the body is willy-nilly entrapped by powerful urges. In other words, pleasure is a value only when you decide to get pleasure and not when you are forced into it by urges that you can't control. Halakha forswears man from the hysteria and insanity of pleasure. The pleasure which the Torah recommends is devoid of excessive intensity, drunken senses. Rather, it has in it the refined beauty and aesthetic splendor of life. When man takes pleasure in the world, in the spirit of halakha, his pleasure is modest and delightful. Pleasure without the mania of illicit sex and without the fervor of gluttony. That's all, folks.
Moderation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Moderation.
But I'd say just because we ended on that note, don't neglect from trying to understand the material at the beginning of the class.
Yes.
Okay. Good evening.
Thank you.